From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour will be made when different parts of the country begin a phased reopening, a gradual re-engagement with the workforce and the economy. Some parts of the United States will do it before others. Germany has already begun a phased economic reopening. We're seeing other countries. Germany is also testing more than twice as many people per capita as we are here. It's a massive difference. Why is that? Well, we've been welcoming members of Congress to help provide thoughts on two big issues during this pandemic. Number one, what do they see as the roadmap forward for that re-engagement with the economy? And number two, what has the government done to help people who are out of work, small business owners, the American worker? What's happening for them? Today, it's a chance to hear from Congressman Tom Reed, who represents New York's 23rd Congressional District. He's been in office for a decade now, and he joins us to discuss what reopening might look like, when testing might ramp up, and what the federal response is helping people out of work. Mr. Congressman, thanks for making the time. How are you?
I'm doing well. And you know, it's always Tom. It's great to be with you.
Well, Mr. Congressman, I understand. I'll do my best here. Let me start by telling our listeners, I know some of you have already emailed, and if you want to call the program, just like Congressman Morelli was on this program, we've got Senator Gillibrand joining us next week, and they're setting aside time to try to offer their thoughts for, generally what help is available and where to get it or what's not available. So I know you're going to have phone calls and emails. We'll get to that coming up, but I want Congressman Reed to start by kind of giving us his thoughts for where we go next here. And you just heard the governor about an hour ago, Tom, talk about, you know, the fact that maybe different parts of New York State should reopen before New York City, and it's going to look different in different places. What are the standards and the criteria for you? What should it look like?
Well, first of all, I appreciate that we penetrated our message to the governor in regards to, you know, what happened in New York City is obviously very tragic, and what's going on there is something that's very difficult. But we're in a different part of the state, a different region, a different whole different population density, a whole different health network system, a whole different economy, if you would, than what is down in New York City. So the regional approach is something I've been a long advocate for, and the same thing applies across the country. And I will just put out in black and white what I think reopening America looks like is what we did in the Problem Solvers Caucus. You know, that caucus I founded on the Republican side, co-chair. There's 50 members, 25 Democrats, 25 Republicans. And when we get to 75% consensus in support, we will unite as a body and officially endorse a policy. And we put together a very detailed plan that we call the Problem Solvers Caucus Back to Work Checklist. It got some national attention, and we've given it to the White House. We've given it to our Senate partners and also, obviously, our House leadership in regards to what we see, how to move forward on this front. And at the top level, you know, we look at this as a multi-front, multi-dimensional dynamic type of checklist. It is taking care of the virus, the health crisis, in a way that makes sure that we can open up the region, the country, if you would, safe enough in those areas. And I'm sure we'll get into the details of what it means to do that, where it's safe enough to open up. You're never going to mitigate the risk to zero. The only time we're going to get to a zero risk on this virus is once we get to a vaccine. So the question is, how do you do that over the next 12 to 18 months that everyone is of consensus that the vaccine will take to get into production and get into delivery across the country? And a lot of requirements of that type of safe enough standard is going to require diagnosis and serological testing, supply chain integrity and confidence that we're going to be able to have the access to PPE and other issues and learn the lessons of what we've dealt with COVID-19 up to date and make sure that we can protect both base capacity and surge capacity of our healthcare system to deal not only with the virus as it goes off, because it will go off, it will have hot spots that develop. And I think, you know, that is something we just have to be honest with the American people on. And any politician who tells you that that we can continue going forward between now and a vaccine and there's not going to be no outbreaks of the virus is just not dealing with reality and is more politically talking point. And then on the economic front, you know, we have to get the businesses in a position to recognize industry by industry. You're not going to open up the economy back to the way it was 3 months ago, and that businesses are going to just kind of go back to their standard operating procedures. You're going to have to look at industry by industry standards, and I think my understanding at the national level, there will be national standards that states will then have to submit an action plan consistent with those standards in order for it to be approved and for the assistance at the federal level to be there. And you'll have social distancing, you'll have mitigation and containment being the cornerstone of those case-by-case approvals in order to make sure that the virus is in check and the business and the risk of operating the business are in check and that you have the ability to do that. So that's kind of a high-level talk, but I'm sure we'll get into some of the details as we go forward.
How close is your district to being in a position to move into a phased reopening? And again, I appreciate the point you're making on when we talk reopening, we're not talking where we were, you know, on February 1, but how close is your district to some kind of first phase?
Very close. I mean, I have a daily call with all of our hospital networks, not just in the district, but I'm talking to the health networks from Buffalo to Rochester, Jamestown to Binghamton, and everything in between. And so from a health capacity and a health the existing existence of COVID-19, the existing base and surge capacity that's been demonstrated in our health network, and the creativity and innovation that I've already seen. You know, I'll just highlight some best practices that are being duplicated as we speak. Cayuga Medical, they stepped forward early on. They're out of Ithaca. Have been very aggressive, and Marty Stellane over there is the chief operator. Just got off the phone with him on another issue here 15 minutes ago. But they put a mobile rapid testing unit together that's fully staffed, fully tested in an inventory, can go to a nursing home, can go to an off-site location, i.e. businesses or where have you, and do a full testing of up to 200 people is what that capacity of that mobile site is. And then the test, and as the technology of the test continues to evolve and get produced and developed, have immediate response on that mobile testing operation. That is, and when I say immediate, obviously we're talking minutes, not hours. But that type of response is what we're going to be needing as we deal with our health networks going forward. So they are demonstrating that they can do it, and the resources are there, and the supply chains obviously are a work in progress, especially when it comes to our testing kits, both serologically, the antibody test, as well as the diagnostic test. But they're talking to the White House, talking to private industry, which we've developed close relationships on the testing and reagent sources in order to make sure that they're in place to meet the demand every day. It is amazing to me how private industry is stepping forward and producing the necessary testing kits and reagent materials in order to get this done.
I have to say, I'm a little surprised to hear you say you're amazed at what. I'm thrilled as a citizen of this country who wants to see this crisis end yesterday. I'm glad to see anybody participating. But we heard from the White House on March 13th. The president said that private industry and national retailers were going to set up drive-through COVID testing sites in parking lots, Walgreens, Rite Aid, Walmart, and Target. And there have been a total of about 16 sites in a country of 330 million people. That was 5.5 weeks ago. And we are still not testing half as many people as Germany. Why have we failed so badly in testing?
Well, I think you had initial delay, is my understanding of some of the regulatory missteps that happened early on. But moving forward and seeing what the technology that's being developed, this is coming on exponentially. And so, you know, to say what happened on March 13th is the exact same condition as to how we exist here on April 22nd is, I don't think, an accurate representation of where we stand today. And so do we have a lot ways to go in regards to meeting the entire demand of 300 million people across the entire nation? Yes, but as we do these regional approaches, you know, I'm very confident talking to our health networks and the health inventories and these health CEOs that have demonstrated to me. We have deployed hundreds of testing. University of Rochester, I'm talking to on a regular basis. They are turning out thousands of tests that they are in a position to potentially be a resource. And if you network and collaborate like these facilities are and these operations are, you can meet these tests. And remember what we're talking about here. I mean, we're talking about two different types of testing standards. We're talking about diagnostic testing and also the antibodies. Because the antibodies, we can get into the debate if you want to, whether or not if you're exposed to the virus, do you have some type of base immunity?
I think most people think you probably would. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I think we're on the same page there. So having that base immunity gauged throughout the region is also critically important. So having both of those tests being deployed is very critical to our success. And then the diagnostic test is obviously that Johnny-on-the-spot rapid deployment type of test that's going to be critical to monitoring where the hotspots are. And then once you get a positive test, that is where part of the action plan is going to be an immediate response from the businesses, from public health workers, that you deploy that health resource to not only treat that individual that tests positive, but then engage in that contact tracing and that immediate containment strategy of the virus as opposed to mass mitigation, which you have now. Because, you know, if we just did mass mitigation, which is just totally social distancing and stay-in-place orders, then essentially we would not move the country for 12 to 18 months.
Yeah, that can't happen.
That's not real. That's not realistic.
No, I don't think anybody.
It would be dangerous to do that.
Oh, I don't think anybody thinks that's possible. I mean, you know, essentially what we're doing is we're playing defense when we do that, and what you're talking about is playing offense against the virus. And so we're talking to Congressman Tom Reed, talking about a plan to move into a phased reopening. You say that you think we're very close to it, so very soon we might see kind of a phase one. So give me 2 points on that. Number one, does that mean next week? Does that mean May? And then, given that it can't be everything, we know that not every business can open the exact same way that it was 3 months ago, as you said. What does life look like in that first phase?
Well, first of all, I think where we stand in New York is it's pretty clear the governor set the marker down on May 15th. He's not moving off May 15th. That's his next date in his mind. So we got a lot of work to do between now and May 15th into this regional approach. And that gives us time to build that test capacity. It builds us time to test the supply chains and make sure there's redundancies in these supply chains and we're dotting the I's and crossing the T's. So I think that's realistic, and that's just the reality. Now, I am glad to hear, and this should give us some optimism that we can do this. As you know, in our region, they have gone to allowing, and I'm not going to use the term but once because I hate it, elective surgery. This isn't what we're talking about when we talk about elective surgery. What we're talking about is turning, opening up these hospitals and these medical providers to treat that base healthcare demand that right now has been turned off. I mean, we're doing a little bit of attending to it with telemedicine and other issues that are there, but that base health demand is in the system, and we need to turn that on. And the governor recognized that, and kudos to the hospital associations for putting forward the effort to get that done, and they've opened it up on April 28th. So if you're talking about risk, if you're talking about how an industry can demonstrate that they can handle the exposure of COVID-19 in its operations, you know, I think you start with looking at what the hospitals are doing for April 28th being the turning on of that hospital assistance and that medical assistance to that outpatient, that other services that are needed to attend to the health needs of Americans outside of COVID-19 situations. And so, you know, that could be a guiding principle. And then, you know, going forward as to phase one, I think you're gonna have to have those plans that are in place so the businesses show that they're engaging in social distancing. They reconfigured their workforces, their places of business, and so you have that separation capability physically, that you have a documented way to make sure that for your business you have the necessary personal protective equipment, be it a mask, be it if there's higher risk, maybe there's a higher level of equipment necessary to keep your workers safe and your customers safe. And then you get into that, you know, how do we interact with the public health from a business perspective operation so that you have an EOC and a HIPAA-compliant operation tapping into that immunization and vaccination resource that is out there existing in legislative format. And this is what Dr. Bill Cassidy, senator from Louisiana talks about extensively and taking the lead on, so that as that information is compiled, as that testing, diagnostic, and serological testing is done, you're getting a centralization compilation of that information in real time, and then your private businesses and your private organizations are interacting with those public health officials and information so that they're mitigating the potential risk with their workplace and customers coming into their places of location.
So it looks like May 15th then is kind of the target goal for a kind of a first phase, yes?
I think that's the realistic given where the governor's at with his order. But, you know, the governor did show that he's willing to go earlier, as you see the hospitals coming in, the medical providers coming online on April 28th in our area. So if we can demonstrate and we can dot our I's and cross our T's early, I'm the eternal optimist, and I think it's we will be in a better position as a region and as a country the sooner we get back to business, whatever that business new normal looks like, sooner. And you know, I would hope his openness to allowing medical service April 29th or 28th will remain, and we can maybe move the ball from May 15th through today. But what I've heard from the powers to be in Albany is that that's pretty a black and white date that he's already carved in stone.
Okay. Congressman Tom Reed joining us for the hour. Listeners, we're going to get to your calls coming up here in just a bit. I want to talk about the economy in just one moment. But the last point on testing is this. When we look at this plan, Mr. Congressman, going forward, that will require us to be able to test more broadly than we do today and certainly a week and 2 weeks ago, here's what I think will concern some people. The White House has told states basically, you know, we'll support you, but you decide, you're kind of on your own here. This week, a Republican governor, Larry Hogan of Maryland, announced that his state had secured 500,000 test kits from South Korea. Had to go to South Korea to get test kits. And the White House, during the president's news briefings, he took a shot at the Republican governor and said, well, he's sort of misinformed. He should have called us. And Hogan says the next day, we called them. I had to go to South Korea. So, you know, I'm watching this whole thing going, what in the world is going on here? We haven't been able to test as well as other countries. It's been sort of an international embarrassment. And you even have Republican governors going to South Korea. Are we going to get the tests we need if we're going to be serious about a phased reopening?
I believe, and I know Larry, and Larry's a good guy, and Larry's a good governor, and he does a really good job there in Maryland. And so what I think the frustration is obviously a lot of that bureaucracy and a lot of that, and I have it in New York. I've been trying to talk to the governor. I've given him my personal cell phone number 20 times now, and I have yet to get a call, and I keep calling, but I don't get any feedback. I get no communication, you know, even though he's, you know, told people publicly, or press publicly, that he's talked to every member of the congressional delegation. I haven't talked to the individual, to the governor in 3 years. So it's not a Republican, Democratic, unique type of problem. I mean, I would encourage more elected officials to pick up the phone and talk to each other more aggressively. And if they don't get an answer they like, just keep going. I mean,
you blame Larry Hogan for this?
No, I don't blame Larry Hogan for it. But what I will tell you what I've done is, for example, midnight on Easter, I had a situation where PPE needed to be delivered, and I went all the way to the deputy director of the state emergency office to get those masks and gowns delivered by sheriff to a local nursing home that needed them. And so I don't blame Larry. I just blame the system. If you think that government bureaucracy is going to run perfectly in this crisis, I just got to tell you, I just don't see that happening. Now, does that mean we should accept it? No, I'm not saying that at all. What I'm saying is, you know, we should be working together. We should be collaborating. And if we don't like the answer we get, go all the way to the top. I mean, I've called the president before, and he's taken my call. He's called me at my house on issues that are important to me. And I think, you know, where we're going with the testing is we also got some additional relief coming here tomorrow with the $25 billion of this 3.5 package, where $25 billion is going to be earmarked specifically for testing. And if you remember what we did in Phase 2, and we were part of that bipartisan effort to get the Phase 2 package, and you remember the Speaker of the House rightfully said it's all about testing, testing, testing in that $100 billion that we did in Phase 2. And it seems like years ago, but it was just about a month and a half ago that money was rolled out. That planted the seed. Now we're going to do an additional $25 billion of resources on testing to build up this capacity to get the testing going forward. And I appreciate the criticism and I appreciate the complaints. But at the end of the day, all we can do is learn from our problems of the past, try to do better, keep pushing all the way to the top, don't give up 24/7, be at this, and then let's move forward and just continue to talk to each other and collaborate with each other out of respect, because at the end of the day, this isn't about a Democrat Republican governor. This is about American citizens that are caught in the crossfire of that type of rhetoric.
Yeah, agree. Couldn't agree more on
that.
Keep
moving forward. Amen.
On the subject of the economy, we're seeing a new deal this week. We saw Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, the president, Chuck Schumer, among others, talking about this deal struck in the Senate. And I just want to get your take as a member of the House on this deal that looks like about $450 to $500 billion more. About $310 of that, according to Secretary Mnuchin, is to resupplement funding for the PPP and Small Business Administration loans, which that money dried up very, very fast. We've heard from small business owners who said they couldn't even get a call in before the money was gone. Do you support this plan here? Is it good enough for the moment, Mr. Congressman?
Absolutely. I mean, we have to get this done. I mean, it's very frustrating that we went past Friday last week when we hit this max. But, you know, again, I'm not going to go back. It's not worth it at this point in time. What I'm going to do is I'll be driving to D.C. tomorrow, making sure this bill passes, and then coming back to the district just like I did for the CARES Act to make sure that happens again, because this money needs to continue to flow through the Paycheck Protection Program. And the additional $60 billion that is on top of that $310 billion for Paycheck Protection Program goes to those economic injury disaster loans, those EIDL SBA-only loans that so many people, they have the $10,000 microgrant that's associated with them. And we need to get that program up and running, too. So it's critical that this program and this bill pass. And so I appreciate, you know, that we got something finally done, but I wish it would have been done last Friday, but I can't turn back the clock, hands of time. And the other good thing that, to your point about the money being tapped into quickly, we did, and I appreciate the set-aside for our smaller banks and our smaller credit unions to make sure that there's $60 billion of that $310 billion that's going to go to that pot of money to kind of, you know, allow the smaller, less sophisticated businesses that don't have those existing relationships to be able to have the time in order to get the paperwork together, in order to make the application. The application is pretty simple. It's pretty straightforward. But, you know, there's a lot of mom-and-pop shops out there that are not in a position of having loans, of having extensive bank account relationships with banks that are out there. So they have to go and compile the information, they have to get the data, and they have to submit it. And so having that additional set aside of $60 billion for that situation, I think, was a wise improvement on the existing PPP program.
We heard from some small business owners and some out-of-work New Yorkers yesterday on the program. Number one, they're very frustrated with the state's unemployment insurance system, and they are also frustrated with the SBA and PPP and what the federal government has decided to do. And I want to play a cut for you to kind of respond to, if you could. It was a phone call with a small business owner in Rochester named Colin Coffey. He owns a company called Renewing Massage. He knows he's going back to work. He's not going back to work anytime soon. He says he gets that. This is a pandemic. We need to protect public health. But he says the state and federal response in particular have been failures. Here's what he said about government relief efforts. He had some tough words for Senator Schumer, Congressman Morelli, and more about what Congress should be doing.
I'm very disappointed in having members of Congress, for example, Joe Morelli, coming on your show and telling everyone that there is support for small businesses. Go out there and get it. It's inexcusable. And it has to stop. They need to take responsibility. They need to be honest. And they need to stop telling our families, our friends, our neighbors, and our clients that self-employed people are being supported and we're all in this together. They really have to take responsibility, step up, admit their failings, and draw a new line and reset. They need to suspend mortgage payments for ordinary working class people who are unemployed, suspend credit card payments, and suspend student loans. It's 101. Any fool would know that's what to do.
Well, that rant got a standing O from a lot of people in small business and out-of-work workers, and so let's hit a couple points there. Number one, he says this idea that the SBA and the PPP is working when you have to apply and there's already been allegations that banks are favoring bigger clients, wealthier clients, getting their applications in first. He says that's like a Hunger Games. The money's going to run out, and businesses are not going to be helped across the board. What would you say to that, Mr. Congressman?
Well, you know, obviously that's why that $60 billion set aside is meant to help that situation. I also think it's a reflection of the structural problems that we do have in the economy, and that you have more sophisticated businesses and you have less sophisticated businesses, and we got to do a better job of improving the system so that they can, you know, be at the same level of receipt of these funds. And to the gentleman's point, I think he's also tapping into people need to understand, I'm talking to elected officials here. The magnitude of this crisis is mind-boggling to me. I mean, I've been here 24/7 dealing with not just the health crisis, but the economic crisis. When you shut off the U.S. economy of $22 trillion essentially overnight, and the velocity of money goes from 1,000 miles per hour down to zero, the casualties in that are unbelievably wide and far. There's not a nook or cranny of this economy that is not impacted by that. And one of the concerns, though, I have with what the gentleman is tapping into is that there's somehow this mindset that there's a bad guy here, that there's that somebody is to blame for this natural disaster. This is something that Mother Nature created. This is a virus that Mother Nature threw at us, and it's not a person who's to blame. It's not a government that failed in regards to addressing that natural disaster as it went off. Now, I agree with you. When we look back, could we learn a lot of lessons from this? Can we be better prepared for the next one? Absolutely. But I will tell you that where we're at right now and what we're trying to do, and I'm trying to be part of, when we put together the Problem Solvers Caucus bipartisan plan that got that 75% consensus, is, you know, we do have to roll up our sleeves and we do have to figure out these government programs. And when they don't work, absolutely be the first ones to step forward and go, you know what, stop, fix it, do a better job, and move forward. That is one of the reasons why I'm very frustrated with Congress right now in regards to the negotiation of, for example, this 3.5, the billions of, you know, the 500 or $480 billion that we'll be passing tomorrow in the House. That was essentially negotiated with four people, which is Chuck Schumer, which is Mitch McConnell.
But you're going to vote for it.
Nancy Pelosi.
You're going to vote for it.
Yeah, but I haven't had any participation in it. Are you kidding me? And then when I have to deal with a farmer who's killed himself, like I had to over the weekend, because he lost all hope because the Paycheck Protection Program expired on Friday, and he killed himself because the check that was promised to him by the operation of government, and I'm going to vote against it because, you know, it's what's being presented to us. So if we vote against it, what's that going to do to the real people? And so to the point of the gentleman, and I share his frustration, and I call upon our leadership, you know what, this is time for Congress to function. And if we can't do remote voting, like I've been trying to advocate for and figure out a way, you know, we do technology, I get it, some members don't like technology, but I am all for Congress functioning during this period of time. So we should be going back to D.C. and staying in D.C. to get phase four taken care of. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't have four people deciding trillions of dollars worth of policy, and what they do, like what they did in the Senate yesterday, is 20 minutes before they voted on it, they released it for them to vote on. That is dangerous for our republic. That is dangerous for our democracy, and I share the frustration of that gentleman to say, you know what, how we're going to fix this stuff is we engage in the congressional process, and we have that debate to improve these programs. But in the meantime, don't use, as I heard last week, we need to have leverage from my colleagues and some on the other side. We need to have leverage of this PPP running out of money and these people showing up without their paychecks. We need to have leverage of those news reports out there so that we can get this piece or this item or this thing thrown into this bucket. You know what you're leveraging? You're leveraging the American people who are caught in harm's way. So I join with that gentleman in saying to my colleagues, don't do that. That is wrong. It's fundamentally not right. And if what we need to do, and if we run over a deadline, then let's agree. Just replace the money going into the PPP program and then continue the debate and continue to improve the program as we go forward. There's no reason why we shouldn't be doing that.
All right, real quick, and then we get to your phone calls. Suspend mortgage payments, yes or no, Tom?
You know, I'm open to that type of relief given the economic crisis and the magnitude of the crisis going on. But as we suspend the mortgage payments and as we suspend rent payments, we better up front, as we go into phase four conversation, deal with how are you going to reopen or unsuspend those payments. What are you going to do to that lump sum that is boiling up? Are you going to forgive it? Are you going to put it on the back end? And also, you have to recognize, what is the ripple effect of those payments not going through the system? Because, yeah, each mortgage payment, if you take it individually, it could be a manageable number. But when you equate it to $22 trillion of the U.S. economy and for 2 to 3, 4 months, there's no money flowing through the system, that jeopardizes the entire underpinnings of the U.S. economy. And so you better have a conversation as we talk about that. We better have a plan in place on how to relieve the back end of it, because you could take care of it for 2 months, 3 months, but you got a liability that's now been created, and you also have a destabilizing effect on the cash flow of that money, that velocity of money no longer going through the system.
All right. And I get the point that this is a nature, you know, a virus that occurred in nature. There's no question about that. But your party cut pandemic preparation. I mean, do you think that that is a problem that should get fixed in the future?
Of course. And when we talk about pandemic preparation and the conversation on TRIA, and we could have a conversation on PREA, because there's some discussion there that I think is appropriate on the business interruption loss and how to ensure these events going forward. I think that would have been very wise for us to have learned the lesson of 9/11 and thought around the corner and over the horizon to say, hey, when you have these once-in-a-generation situations, how can you best risk mitigate it going forward? So I'm a big I'm a big proponent of having the discussion of a PREA type of, you know, the Terrorism Risk Act, having a Pandemic Risk Act to try to mitigate this going forward long term. But you know, when you talk about we cut pandemic, you know, this is the age old problem in Washington D.C. Everybody is looking for additional money, and we're running, just remember, we're running a $1 trillion deficit, and everybody's looking to reduce spending. So because it's not an emergency today, what gets cut? Those items that are typically on the horizon where people are like, you know, that's not going to happen for 100 years. So why don't we reduce funding there, and we'll make sure that we get to it next year. And both parties did that. Both parties did that. To think that there hasn't been reductions in spending previously by Democratic administration, Republican administrations, that's just playing into the partisan rhetoric, and I'm not going to bite on it. But the reductions there obviously have put us in this position to a degree, and we should learn from it. And we should replenish the national stockpile. We should replenish the funding to recognize that this is not the first time we're going to be dealing with a virus. It won't be the last time, and I hope it's another 100 years. You know, last time we dealt with something like this was 1918, and maybe we should have learned a lesson of 1918, but it is amazing how quick we as a country forget the lessons of our history, and hopefully we don't do that again going forward.
Congressman Tom Reed, our guest for the hour. After our only break, your questions for him. He's told us earlier this hour that we're not far away from a phased reopening, at least in the 23rd District here and in Western New York here, different than it would be in New York City. So building up towards May 15th, but also taking the steps between now and then to put ourselves in position to kind of work through what that looks like, more testing, hopefully more tracing, maybe antibody testing, and a lot more. Your phone calls and questions for him next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. Help from the experts regarding small business loans, help from the federal government, relief for workers, and more. If you didn't get a claim processed, if the SBA ran out of money before anyone would take your call, this is your chance to find out what to do next, especially in light of the fact that there is a new deal coming through Congress. The experts will help. Any questions you have, Thursday on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mike in Rochester next. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes, thanks for having me on, Congressman. I have a question for you that I listened to part of the governor's speech today. And what struck me, and it's been striking me for a long time, he kept saying, we need these supplies, and all I keep hearing is China. China supplies us with everything, and we know that. What I don't understand, and this goes back for both administrations, I just hope and plead with you that when you go back to Congress, that you have a discussion about how we outsource such important items that are really necessary in this country. And I don't understand it. We have an oil reserve. If we had a biological attack, our military wouldn't be prepared because China supplies us with all these masks and ventilators and all these things. I mean, this should be a national priority that things that our country needs to survive should be produced in this country.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Go ahead, Mr. Congressman.
Yeah, no, Mike, I really appreciate that. And one of the cornerstones of our Back to Work Problem Solvers Caucus checklist is exactly that. When we look at the economic recovery that is necessary, is to examine our supply chains, to examine our sourcing of critical minerals, of critical supply inputs, especially when it comes to pharmaceutical and medical equipment, because this is clearly highlighted, this risk that we now find ourselves in regards to these international global sourced inputs. And China obviously is the biggest elephant that supplies that type of resource. So we are already calling for that, and we are calling for folks in America to the opportunity here, and I always try to look at things from a positive perspective, and COVID-19 brings a lot of negative, obviously, into our debate and our conversation. But the positive here is I think people are waking up and saying, you know what, this dependency outside of American resources, or at least not having a solid redundancy plan in place so that there's multiple vectors for these supply chains to be established and be dependent upon, is going to take a real root. And so it's going to be an issue with China. I was already concerned about the rise of China. I was already having them on our horizon in regards to the world order and the economic power that China is amassing vis-a-vis the U.S. economy. And so I think you're going to see a vigorous debate in America that says, you know what, this symbiotic relationship that people envisioned with China is may not going to be the long-term relationship between the two of us, and that it's time that we respect that and that we position America to be in a position of self-sufficiency.
Well, we're going to have to tell people that for the short term, just getting things as cheaply as possible from China might not be the best idea anymore. You think you can convince people of that, Mr. Congressman?
I think we can, given the nature of the backdrop of what we're talking about, because that's exactly the point, right? That's exactly the issue that's going to be here is, you know, short term, and this is the lessons of history that we often forget, and as we talked about prior to the break, is that, look, maybe it isn't as cheap as we thought it was. Yeah, maybe at the point of sale it was cheap, but look at the cost now. We just spent, and these taxpayers are going to be footing this bill. It's not as if this money coming out of the federal coffers to cover the $2.8 trillion just released now, and what's going to be on top of that coming down the pipeline, you know, taxpayers are going to have to foot that bill. So how do you equate that number into that point-of-sale cheap consumer product that we have become accustomed to in America? And the economic impacts of that are significant. We are a consumer-based economy. And I think this is going to awaken a tremendous amount of debate for the future of the country as to, is that the economic model that we want to completely put all our eggs in one basket on? I believe we can do better than just one approach to our economy going forward. I believe in U.S. manufacturing. I believe manufacturing was at the precipice of reestablishing itself in America. And you got automation, you got innovation, you got technology coming down. That brings along a lot of problems, and we've heard that debate prior to COVID-19 crisis. But I think we're going to have this debate coming out of this crisis with a backdrop that allows us to look at this in a much different lens than what we were looking at it prior to this virus going off.
All right, let's get back to your phone calls. Got to keep it as tight as we can. A lot to work through. Bonnie in Rochester. Hi, Bonnie.
Yeah, we generally like the cheaper ways anyway. Yeah, my main question, though, was that I think I'm going to, I lean toward trying to evaluate the issue of the virus in terms of how much should be open and not, based on, frankly, to what extent are the people who are making these changes or advocating for them, the congressmen and others like him and other congresspeople, to what extent are they going to put themselves in the gray areas, let's call them for right now. Well-intended, maybe, but until we get the virus, until we get the vaccine, there is no such thing as pure safety. So to what extent are they going to? So one of the ways I measure that would be to ask this kind of question of the congressman and Morelli and all of them. When are you going to start using for your main transportation, public transportation, which means primarily I'm talking about bus pretty much?
Mr. Congressman, you want to answer that?
Well, I mean, I live in a different area than in the city of Rochester. I don't live in an urban area, so I think you're going to have to recognize that even me as a member of Congress living in a different area, that this regional approach is not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach, even within the region, that we're going to have to adapt given the nature of not just the transportation network, but also the population density of each of the communities and areas that are there. And I will tell you, I'm open, like for example, going back to work, and I'm open. We should be on the floor of the House. There's ways that we could social distancing, distance there. There's way we could use masks. There's way we could use PPE. We could engage in the legislative process. This idea that, it's too risky for members of Congress to be in Washington, D.C. and doing their job just doesn't make sense to me. And I would just say that, if we have healthcare workers going into hotspots like we did and do in New York City, I don't understand why we don't have the same ability for us to go in a hot spot of the chamber of the United States House of Representatives.
Sure. On transportation, what percentage of your district, what percentage of households in your district own cars?
I would imagine that's a pretty high number, given that we're about the size of the state of New Jersey, and I would think that that's got to be pushing 90% plus in regards to people that own a car there. I mean, I don't have that number off the top of my head, Evan, but I will tell you, that's one of the primary means of travel. But as you deal with transportation, that's a legitimate and great question to ask as we put an action plan together. So if you're in the city of Rochester, you're in the city of Buffalo. I used to live in the city of Rochester right there on Goodman Park Avenue, so I know it very well. There's a lot of public transportation there, but even there was a lot of car travel. But if the point is, how do you ride a bus with appropriate social distancing, with the appropriate masking, I think what we could do is we could actually do that. I know the Rochester Transit Authority well. Those guys have, I believe Jim Carpenter is still over there, and he comes in our office, and we talk to him quite a bit. I think if you said to him, how would you make sure you mitigate the risk of the traveling public in a bus system, what would you do? Now, again, you're not going to mitigate it to zero. The virus is going to be there. Mm-hmm. And so we just have to recognize that risk is going to exist. So what would you do? And I would offer you some guidance that I think from the research and the time I've invested in looking at this type of stuff is, how would you have the capacity on the bus limited so that you have the ability to keep a 6-foot distance between each other? What would you require your riders to wear coming on? Probably a mask. What would you do in regards to once the bus, how long would it travel before you have to sanitize it? What kind of sanitizing material would you utilize in order to make sure that you're accomplishing that? And then how would you keep your bus driver separate from the traveling public, because you want to protect that employee who's going to be exposed to hundreds if not thousands of people as he does or she does her tour of duty. And so you're going to have to maybe retrofit those buses to have physical separation, be a plexiglass, et cetera. You've seen that at the grocery stores. You've seen what Wegmans has done. And so those would be the action plan items I would go and request of the industry to say, how are you going to accomplish that? And then as a congressman, I would be more than willing to go on that bus to demonstrate that I feel confident that we have done this safe enough for us to participate in that. And I would encourage elected officials. If you want me to come up to Rochester, I come up there quite a bit. I've been in your studio numerous times, Evan, and I would more than willing to demonstrate my commitment to that safety. And I think that would be wise for us to get on that bus and show the traveling public, you know what, I'm willing to do this because I believe this risk has been mitigated sufficiently that it makes sense for us to open up and have this delivery transportation system work this way.
All right, Congressman Tom Reed, for the last bit of the hour here, working in as many questions as we can. Dominic wants to know if you support funding for states. Essentially, he's picking up on the fact that Governor Cuomo met at the White House with the president yesterday, bringing the message not only from him but from a lot of governors, both parties, saying if the federal government doesn't offer money for states, we can't, you know, spend more than our budgets. You can, and we are about to be in austerity pain here for a while if you don't help us. What do
Amen.
You say to that? Yeah,
I totally agree, and I'll tell you, we've already mobilized, and I think we positioned very well in regards to the 3.5 negotiations that occurred going through this. So I've worked with the Association of Counties, the NICOM, the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the National Association of Counties, and as a Republican, I fully support state and local aid. And then this narrative out there that all Republicans are opposed to state and local aid. And as I talked with them, I'm very happy that Pelosi and Schumer came to an agreement on the new formula mechanism when they put this proposal forward in these negotiations 3.5 that aren't in the bill but have set the debate for phase four. And that formula is a revised CDBG, getting into the details if you would like, we can. But essentially the formula ensures that local governments get a fair shake of that resource being distributed. Because the original formula, 45 out of the 61 counties of New York would have got $0. And so that new formula is very good, and I put a public statement out on Sunday for that. And I applaud Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer coming to an agreement on that revised formula. There is one ask that I'm going to be adamant about, and that's what I call the maintenance of efforts provision as we go forward. And what that means is I was there in 2008 as a former mayor, and having seen this and worked with the municipalities, what we cannot have happen is when we secure local aid and state aid, and we will, and there was a good meeting at the White House, and if you saw the president after 3.5 was done, you know, he indicated support for state and local aid. So that, and I've delivered that message to the White House as well as the powers to be in the Senate and the House, that I'm going to be a Republican all in on this issue. But we have to protect the local and state, the local governments, by this maintenance of efforts provision that needs to be in here. And what that means is essentially when we get a dollar of federal aid directly delivered to the mayor of the city of Rochester, we have to make sure that the governor at the state does not take out an equal dollar from the traditional assistance programs that go to the state for their assistance from the state. I've seen that before, and you see it in the AIM lines of the budget. You see it, potentially they can get into the CHIPS money. It's difficult, but you can get into there. And with the governor having 90-day independent authority to adjust the state budget authorities, and we're seeing it right now with the school districts where the foundational aid is being played with this way, we got to make sure that, hey, governor, you cannot reduce your local state school district budgets in the state budget and assistance lines in the state budget in a corresponding amount that they're getting from the federal coffers and the federal aid lines. It's very critical, in my opinion, in order to make this a bipartisan deal, that maintenance of efforts language is in any state aid assistance that comes in phase four. Let's see where it goes, but I can tell you the governor's not going to like that. But where the governor will be taken care of is I will advocate, as I did with a letter. I've sent two letters of a delegation, a led effort in New York State. I'm all for state aid. I'm all for local aid. And the state aid lines will be separate and distinct from the local aid, and you can't have the state gobbling up the local direct federal aid by moving and playing that bait-and-switch game that the state government plays all the time with our local governments.
All right, got to keep it tight here. Another listener emails to ask if this pandemic has changed your view toward health care options, essentially saying when you've got millions of people forced out of work through no fault of their own and their health insurance is tied to them having a job, is it time to change systems? Mr. Congressman?
I really see it. If you talking about the underlying response, a government response to this pandemic, it reaffirms a contrary opinion. To think that government can run our healthcare system much better than the private sector, and we got many improvements that we have to do in this private-based healthcare system in America. Agree with you on that. But I don't know, given the criticism that we heard in the first half hour of how the government responded to this crisis and is responding to the crisis going forward, and rightfully so, that criticism is legit. I don't know how that reinforces the confidence that we should turn our entire healthcare system over to the government to control such a precious item such as our healthcare in America.
If we are going to be rephasing or reopening in phases, really starting May 15th or thereabouts, what would prevent that from happening, Mr. Congressman? 30 seconds. What could derail that?
So I think it's that the biggest critical piece to me is making sure that the supply chain and the delivery of that testing, both serological and diagnostic, is checked, double-checked, and confirmed, and making sure that our health networks are on board with that collaborative approach that will be necessary to do it. So those are the two things that, if did not come to be, could derail that.
I want to thank you for the time, and I know that your schedule remains very busy. It will be throughout this crisis, but we hope we can check in with you and your colleagues in the Congress. It's a great service for our listeners, and I know they're relying on Washington for a lot these days. Thank you for making the time for this program.
We're standing together, Evan, and reed.house.gov. Whatever I can do to help anyone, we're here 24/7.
And I know that you'll hear from them. Reed.house.gov, that is Congressman Tom Reed joining us for the hour here. And as we let him go, we want to let our listeners know about an opportunity that you can engage with local medical researchers about COVID-19. Tomorrow night, 8 p.m., I'm going to be hosting a community forum with scientists from the University of Rochester Medical Center and Rochester Regional Health. They are at the forefront of vaccine development and treatment of COVID-19. And we're going to talk to them about how they are fighting this disease right now. We also want to know what you want to know. Email us, forum@wxxi.org. forum@wxxi.org. You can watch the WXXI Live Forum, Fighting COVID-19, on WXXI TV tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, AM 1370 as well. You can also stream it on the WXXI News Facebook page and the WXXI website. Tremendous team putting together what should be a packed informational hour about where we go next. Vaccine, treatment, we're going to talk remdesivir, other options, and a lot more. Thanks from the whole team today here at Connections. Emma Stein is the intern, Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Max, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.